Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we catch up on politics from the last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Joining me for the roundtable this week, we have Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back, Haley.
Good to be here.
Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio. Welcome back, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
And Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Welcome back, Shane.
Good morning.
So pressure is mounting for all of the Jeffrey Epstein files to be released. And last week, a group of women survivors gathered on Capitol Hill to push for all the documents to be made public. One of the women, Annie Farmer, after the press conference ended, was asked by reporters about one-time Epstein friend and billionaire Les Wexner. She went back up to the microphone, and with a reporter asking her a question, this is what she told the gathering.
Oh, you want to address you, that, I just want to say one thing that's very clear, when people say, you know, please share names, there are names that are very well known, like that of Les Wexner, who everyone knows supplied an enormous amount of Epstein's, you know, financial wealth and allowed this operation to happen. So it's, I think, confusing to many of us why there have not been more ramifications for him. And he's been seen as a victim when clearly I believe there's more to it.
So it's important to point out that Wexner has not been charged with any crime or tied to the sex trafficking charges that landed Epstein in jail, where his death was ruled a suicide. But the connection was made. Jake, what do you make of hearing Wexner's name, a really important name in here in Central Ohio, said on Capitol Hill in this context?
I just think that everyone linked to Jeffrey Epstein, however tenuous, is on the hook here, at least in terms of reputation. Although with so much talk about Les Wexner, there's an excellent story in today's New York Times that Chase Bank was doing banking and generating enormous fees from Jeffrey Epstein. So they, too, were finding ways to profit and make money with this guy. And then there are inklings in the story, which I'd really encourage people to read, that even all the way up to Jamie Dimon, they say that if he wasn't directly engaged in saying, yes, we should continue to bank with this man who's been convicted of a child sex crime, at least he was too disengaged to be paying attention despite people trying to bring it to his attention. So I think it just goes to show you that anyone who is in business with this person is at least in terms of association and the court of public opinion, you know, they're all going to come up in the same Google results as Jeffrey Epstein.
And to Annie Farmer's comments where she called Wexner a victim, she's referring to the money he lost. Epstein was his financial manager for years, and Wexner did lose a ton of money with him. Haley, what do you think? I mean, Wexner's name is in a lot of places around Central Ohio. So do you think that there's some businesses or nonprofits around here that may think about cutting ties?
It's hard to say. I think if people thought seriously about cutting ties with him, they would have done it by now. I think something more concrete would need to come out for that to happen, especially given the influence of the Wexner family in Central Ohio. But, you know, going back to what Annie Farmer said, I just want to remind folks who may not remember this that I think part of why she is particularly, she went out of her way to mention Wexner is because her sister, Maria Farmer, said that she was molested by Epstein at in New Albany, where, you know, Wexner and Epstein had a property. And so, you know, there have been allegations of wrongdoing in Central Ohio. That does not implicate Wexner, of course, but I think that just adds to the speculation about Wexner and Epstein's relationship, especially when there was a lot of commentary at the time, especially when Epstein was first charged, about kind of the strange relationship between Epstein mm-hmm. and Wexner and the influence that Wexner gave Epstein over his finances, making him power of attorney, things like that.
And Shane, just to jump in about the political nature of this, politically, this is one issue that President Trump has faced flack about from both parties, from his own party. What do you make of the fact that this is something, you know, I guess, being anti-Epstein and anything associated with him crosses party lines.
It's just a manner of trying to seize on the moment. I mean, Republicans were really pushing on the Epstein thing when Biden was in power, and they were kind of not really releasing much out of the DOJ about what they had on Epstein. And now that Trump's in charge and his DOJ isn't releasing stuff to the extent of that people want to see it, now he's the target of it. And Democrats definitely right now are seeing, they think, their moment. So you're starting to see it come. I mean, last week, Amy Acton put out a press release saying, where does Vivek stand on releasing the Epstein files? So, I mean, they're definitely want to make this as an issue in 2026.
Yeah. Jake, I wasn't surprised, I guess, to see a press release from Amy Acton calling on her challenger, Vivek Ramaswamy, to join her in demanding release of the Epstein files. I don't know what that'll come of politically, but what do you make of it being an issue in something as like the Ohio governor's race?
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing about it is I believe that I haven't seen the press release, but I saw her tweet, which to largely the same effect. But she had dug up an old tweet of Vivek Ramaswamy saying, it's time, you know, Joe Biden's DOJ, let's release the Epstein files. And right now, a demand to release the Epstein files is a shot at Donald Trump. A different, you know, they're not releasing it. Donald Trump is the person with the keys there. So I think it's an interesting tactic of just, do these things mean anything anymore? You know, when you make a claim and then just instantly jump on the other side of an issue because of who's in the Oval Office, does that matter politically? I don't know the answer to the question, but it's just an interesting thread to see, especially someone like Amy Acton pull on. You know, Amy Acton's not an Epstein truther. You know, this isn't her brand of politics, as I understood it. So I'm curious if something like this can be effective.
All right. Well, we will leave Epstein and Wexner there for now, but it is something that, you know, came up on Capitol Hill. So it does tie in here in Central Ohio. You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. With me this week, we have Jake Zuckerman from Signal Ohio, Haley B. Miller from the Columbus Dispatch, and Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service. Will more members of Ohio's National Guard be called to other cities? The president has called out crime in cities such as D.C., Chicago, Baltimore, New Orleans, Memphis. Most, not all, are Democratic-led cities. Do you think that the Ohio National Guard will end up in more cities after Washington, D.C.? Haley, what do you think?
I mean, I think it depends what Trump decides to do, of course. He has talked a lot about sending troops to this or that city. We haven't seen him make good on any of those pledges yet, so it remains to be seen. You know, another question too is to what extent, you know, Governor Mike DeWine wants to continue pulling away National Guard troops from Ohio. I'm not aware of any imminent safety concern in Ohio right now that would warrant the use of the Ohio National Guard at home, but, you know, that's, you can't plan for those things. And so is there a risk from DeWine's perspective of, you know, having the Ohio Guard stretched too thin if troops continue to appear in other cities?
Yeah. And the New York Times reported last week, and they pointed out, the reporter pointed out, that the Republican governors who sent troops to D.C., Ohio included, could have kept their troops at home within their own state to help their own cities, because crime in some of these cities does exceed crime in D.C. The article cited Cleveland, Dayton, and Toledo here in Ohio, according to FBI statistics, to have similar amounts of crime to D.C., if not more. So, Jake, what do you make? Do you think DeWine should be sending the National Guard to Cleveland instead of D.C.?
Yeah, I think I'd say two things to that. For one is that Ohio cities, you know, they don't want the National Guard there. These state cities do not. The governor said in that New York Times story something that effective state law doesn't allow us to send the guard into these cities without a local request. It apparently has no such problems with Washington, D.C., who an entire city's apparatus says, no, we do not want these troops here. And these states are saying, well, you're getting them anyways. Mm. And number two, something that sticks out to me about the crime data, you know, it's true that violent crime rates are higher in other cities besides D.C., and so logically the troops should go there. But I notice when the Trump administration talks about this, they don't talk about violent – like J.D. Vance in Union Station, when he was getting heckled, he was saying we need to go fight crime. But then when he drills into it, he talked about homeless people. He talked about people having mental health episodes. He talked about drug use. So these aren't things that come up in violent crime statistics. They're really more – disorder. I think there are the things that give people this erroneous sense that crime is worse. So I don't know exactly how to square that circle, but it's just always something that sticks out a little.
Yeah.
I think it's worth noting too, and I am not a legal expert, so I won't pretend to know the details of this, but my understanding, just based on what I've read, is that the federal government does have more leeway when it comes to DC, or at least believes that it does. And I think a lot of those arguments are not applicable to somewhere like Chicago, for instance. We saw use of the National Guard in Los Angeles, and that's been contested in court since then. So I think it's easier, essentially, for Trump to do stuff like this in D.C. I think it becomes more complicated when you're talking about other states.
And Shane, the governor has faced a lot of pushback about this. I mean, people have not been quiet about saying that they wish that he was not sending Ohio troops to D.C. Do you think other lawmakers will chime in as they come back from their summer break?
Yes and no. I don't know how if the president starts sending troops to Chicago, National Guard troops to Chicago and other cities, and Ohio falls suit, then it becomes a fresh topic again. Mm-hmm. Then you'll definitely see him pushing back. Whether or not they're going to be pushing back to them sending it to D.C., I mean, that was a few weeks ago. And when we're in this 24-hour news cycle, there's probably new things that they'll want to focus on instead, especially with like redistricting and other topics coming up.
Yeah. Do we know, Jake, does it cost Ohio any money to do this?
The National Guard has said that no, it is someone else's money. It's the federal government's money that's paying the tap here, which I think adds to the calculus a little bit for DeWine of, well, you know, I mean, it just, I'd suggest it signals skepticism that he's not doing this in Ohio cities that are more violent than D.C. So that kind of points to this idea of, well, someone else is paying for it. Trump wants it. You know, some of these National Guard troops are just laying down mulch and beautifying the National Mall. I just think that there's sort of a what the heck mentality.
Mm-hmm. I saw a picture of some of them picking up trash. So, yeah. All right. Well, we'll move on to another issue. Ohio native J.D. Vance and state senators earlier this year were lobbying President Trump to locate the U.S. Space Force headquarters here to Ohio, the birthplace of aviation. But instead, President Trump picked Huntsville, Alabama, and relocated this command center from Colorado. Haley, Vance had a quote that he lobbied the president hard to put it in Ohio. So Ohio is still hoping to land the NASA headquarters when that lease expires in 2028. What did Ohio do to try to get the Space Force here?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've heard from Vance and other folks trying to highlight the connections Ohio has to, you know, the Wright brothers, flight, space. I mean, there's just a lot of those connections here. And I think, you know, they talked a lot about that and have said that, too, that Ohio is, you know, an affordable place to do, to run a business, to run a government entity, things like that. So, you know, maybe we'll get NASA. I'm not mm-hmm. sure. And I'm not totally sure how Alabama ended up winning out. But, you know, I think when it comes to things like this, you have a lot of people competing. And
yeah, I had honestly forgotten the Space Force existed until like recently. I don't did Ohio want the Space Force?
I think anyone would want, you know, I mean, whether
space
it's a
cool.
Space Force
yeah.
or whatever, it's an agency, it's a bunch of money, it's a bunch of good jobs, you know, any mm-hmm. any jurisdiction would want it. I think Alabama has a pretty long history with space flight, you know. I mean, it just sounds like Ohio's connection to space is a little tenuous. You know, the Wright brothers stayed within our atmosphere.
So well, John Glenn too.
Yeah. I mean, home of John Glenn. You know, why not home
Armstrong.
Of the Space Force? Yeah, we have a lot of connections to space here, right? They're just kind of old.
People hate it so much they're just trying to get out of here.
Yeah. All right. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about redistricting in Ohio and work to get more residents involved in making these maps. That's when the Reporter Roundtable continues from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR. You're listening to All Sides and the Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk about all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Still with me, we have Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service, Jake Zuckerman, a reporter for Signal Ohio, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Shane, Ohio House Speaker Matt Huffman and Senate President Rob McCauley last week announced the launch of a website that will allow the public to submit proposed congressional redistricting maps. What led them to wanting to let the public draw a map and submit it?
Well, because it's required under the Constitution. There are provisions that says that they have to have some kind of avenue for the public to submit their own ideas. However, there's nothing in the Constitution that says they have to actually take a look at them, even use them in their input. But they do have to give the public a chance to weigh in on it.
And Haley, lawmakers have, give us the timeline here. They have to do something with the maps, and there's different dates. Or Shane, do you want to talk about the timeline?
I can feel that. Okay. I'm all things redistricting.
Great.
So the Constitution sets up a kind of a three-step process. So the first part of it, which we're in now, it goes to the General Assembly. The General Assembly has until the end of this month to try and come up with some kind of congressional plan that to draw the lines, but it has to have bipartisan support.
Even one Democrat, or what is that?
I think there's a percentage of
okay.
I would have to double check, but there's a percentage of it. It's I don't think it's just one Democrat. I think you have to have a percentage of the caucus. Like you have to have so many votes, and a number of them have to be Democrats.
Okay.
Failing that, it goes to our old friends at the Ohio Redistricting Commission, and that's the panel. They draw the state legislative lines, and it includes the governor, the auditor, the secretary of state, and it includes two members from the minority leader and the majority leader from each chamber. Mm-hmm. They get an appointment. They usually appoint themselves. So it goes to them. They get a crack at it. They have till the end of October. If they don't come up with a plan that also has to have a bipartisan support, it goes back to the General Assembly. And the General Assembly gets one more crack at it. They have until the end of November. But this time, they can pass it with just a simple majority. Hmm. Now, the one thing is, if they do it at the beginning of the decade, if it doesn't have bipartisan support, it only lasts 4 years. That's why we're going through this process all over again. Ohio is the only state in the country that is being required to redraw its congressional lines this time around. All the other ones are doing it on their own volition.
Hmm. Yeah. So we're hearing about redistricting all over the country, but here in Ohio, we have to do it because we didn't have an agreement.
We have to because there was not bipartisan support on the map that is currently being used. And it's the map that was also... I mean, the Ohio Supreme Court said it was unconstitutional. Now, we have a completely different Ohio Supreme Court now, so we'll see what they do with this one. There will likely be challenges if there is not bipartisan support for it.
And, Haley, the map right now, we have 15 congressional seats. 10 are Republican, 5 are Democrat. The move around the country is that President Trump wants people to draw these lines to give... give him more Republicans. So what do you think is, what's the behind the scenes talk? Are they going to move the lines around?
Yeah, I think you've heard a lot of folks say that the goal is to get a 13-2 map in Ohio.
That'd be a big switch. All right.
That would. The most vulnerable Democrat in Ohio is probably Marcy Kaptur up in the Toledo area. Republicans have been trying to draw her out of office for a while now. She's benefited from a very long tenure and strong incumbency, as well as some pretty weak opponents the last couple election cycles. So she has resisted those efforts so far. We'll see what happens this time. Representative Amelia Sykes in the Akron area is also considered to be very vulnerable. Republicans are eyeing her district, trying to see if they can make life harder for there. I think another target, but a loftier one, is Greg Landsman in the Cincinnati area. there have been some murmurs of maybe trying to get more Republican support in that congressional district, but that's a little tougher because under the current rules, you have to keep cities whole, so you have to keep Cincinnati whole. And so, you know, if you're not splitting Cincinnati up, which has increasingly become more Democratic, then I think it's harder to make significant inroads there if you're a Republican.
Well, we mentioned this idea of Ohioans participating. Jen Miller, the executive director of the League of Women Voters of Ohio, encourages Ohioans to participate, to propose their own maps. She also addressed why more input helps.
Representation works better when districts are drawn that keep communities together, that do not unnecessarily slice and dice neighborhoods and towns. And ultimately, that leads to better representation, where lawmakers have a group of constituents that have more or less similar economic and policy needs.
I mean, Jake, you know, as Shane said, they have to let people submit a map, but they don't have to look at them. So why do you think do you think anyone will? Like, will people just submit maps for fun?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really know what effect these will have, but I'll point out we have this in legislation too. You know, all the time you have unpopular Bill X and 1,000 constituents come in to oppose it versus the 5 who come in to support it, and the bill passes. And you could say that, well, at least people had the chance to speak their piece, or you could say 1,000 people were ignored. I kind of think that they're just going to do what they are going to do. If you have the power to do something, you're going to do it. I'm a little skeptical of the idea that they're just going to look at the compelling ideas of the good people of Ohio and change course.
Shane, what do you think?
The one thing, though, that it can do is then you have some examples of some other not that it's going to sway. The Republicans are going to do what the Republicans are going to do. And if the Democrats are in charge, they're going to do what they're going to do. But it would give some examples, and you can point to it and say, this is a reason why these maps are so egregious. Look at this map that was drawn by so-and-so. It keeps all these communities together, or it doesn't make some of these choices that were clearly made to benefit one party. Mm.
Haley, Vice President J.D. Vance recently had a sit-down with USA Today for an exclusive interview. We mentioned briefly on the roundtable last week that he talked about redistricting, and he said that Democrats have rigged the game. It was a wide-ranging interview about a lot of things, but on the topic of redistricting, it seems like no matter who's in power, the other side is rigging the maps always.
I think it is accurate to say that both parties have taken advantage of the redistricting process to increase their power in the states that they control. I'm from Illinois. Illinois' congressional map is very, very favored to Democrats. A lot of people say that it's gerrymandered. A lot of people say Ohio's map is gerrymandered. You know, this is just part of the game in some ways. And I think with this mid-cycle redistricting that you're seeing in places like Texas, perhaps California now, instead of doing, and unlike Ohio, these states don't have to do it. And it's becoming this tool ahead of the midterms next year to increase majorities for either party. And that's something we haven't really seen before. But historically, redistricting has always been very political, and both sides have weaponized it.
Mm-hmm. So there was a Pew Charitable Trusts did an analysis that they put out last month. And they were talking about how this mid-decade redistricting is very rare in modern times. Now, it used to be way back in the 1800s. They would do it all the time. The Ohio General Assembly, I think, had a decade or two back in the 1800s where every time a different party would take over, they redrew the lines. But modern times, it's only been done about two or three times in the last 25 years or so.
We're in unprecedented times, aren't we? You're listening to All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jarovich. With me, we have Shane Stegmiller from Hannah News Service, Haley B. Miller of the Columbus Dispatch, and Jake Zuckerman of Signal Ohio. I wanted to talk a little bit about the U.S. Senate race for 2026. Before we talk about that, though, I wanted to talk about current U.S. Senator Bernie Moreno. Haley, you wrote about his growing stature as a role as one of the top Trump advocates. How has Moreno, who is new to the Senate, how has he gained so much support or like shown so much defense of Trump.
Yeah, it's his time in the Senate so far has been pretty interesting to me. I mean, he campaigned on being a Trump guy, and he's very much delivered on that since he took office. And as a result, he's gotten a leadership position in the Senate, which is incredibly rare for the Senate, especially since the Senate tends to value seniority. So I think that just goes to show that people, at least Republicans, like the work that he's doing. We've seen Marino put himself at the center of a lot of pretty contentious issues in Ohio and nationally. One of the most recent examples being that big fight in Cincinnati that went viral. You know, he really jumped on that and jumped on the narrative that crime in Democratic-led cities like Cincinnati is out of control, frustrated a lot of local leaders there, including the mayor. But the mayor has also said he's a little bit more optimistic now because in recent weeks the rhetoric has calmed down a little. He and Marino have talked a little, but yeah, I think just goes to show, you know, he's willing to, you know, say whatever.
Yeah. Shane, what do you make of our other senator, John Husted? Is he trying to make a name of himself nationally?
He is. I mean, he has been involved in, he's definitely weighed in on a lot of the contentious issues, and he has definitely been defending the Trump administration on a lot of these issues. He made an appearance last week. One of the big national headlines last week was RFK Jr.'s testimony in the Senate. On Friday, he weighed in on that, and he talked about vaccine policy, saying that he doesn't think the federal government should be mandating people to take vaccines, but he also said, you know, they should be available to people who want them, and, you know, talked about trying to rebuild trust into some of these institutions.
And Jake, he's been, Senator Husted has been touting that he has gotten a couple of union endorsements. Do you know about these?
Yeah, up in Northwest Ohio, I think.
So the Northwest Ohio Building Trades Council, which is an umbrella group of unions in the Toledo area, has endorsed John Husted, which is probably like a shot against Sherrod Brown, because Sherrod Brown is like known as being a union backer kind of Democrat. So Husted in a press release said he won the endorsement of the International Union of Operating Engineers. So it's he has two labor endorsements. Do you think that Husted will... I mean, does a couple labor endorsements bode well for Husted in the Senate campaign against Sherrod Brown?
Yeah, I mean, that's a key plank of Sherrod Brown's political strength has always been unions. And this has been happening for some time. I think unions, their membership, like just the actual people, you know, the laborers who make up a union have drifted to the right. Union leadership has grown increasingly receptive, especially in the construction trades, affiliated trades. So... yeah, I mean, I think it's an ominous sign for Sherrod Brown that these are his people who are backing his opponent. These are who are once his people are backing his opponent.
Haley, do you have anything to add about unions?
I agree with Jake. I think, you know, we've seen that shift in general. I would just note that Sherrod Brown is also still raking in union endorsements. A lot of the bigger ones in Ohio came out pretty soon after he announced his campaign and got behind him. But I do think it's an important point that Jake raised, that you do have this division in unions that we've seen since Trump, where, you know, it's what do the members want versus what do the leaders want. So I guess we'll see if either candidate continues to receive union endorsements. I mean, I certainly don't think all of the unions have endorsed yet.
Yeah. And Shane, speaking of endorsements and such, you covered the Ohio Republican Party met on Friday. Was there anything to note out of that? Did they make any announcements?
So the thing to note out of that was what didn't happen. They were going to originally, there was talk they were going to endorse a candidate in the Supreme Court race, which they did. However, the candidate they endorsed was Justice Dan Hawkins, who's running for re-election. The other big race next year is that of Jennifer Bruner's seat. Now, you'll recall Jennifer Bruner is the last statewide Democrat who is in office. She's the only Democrat on the Supreme Court. And Democrats have not been able to win any Supreme Court seats ever since the Republican lawmakers changed the rules so that your party affiliation appears on the ballot during the general election. So last month, a screening committee of the state party met, and they were screening candidates, and they decided to give the recommendation of the endorsement to Ron Lewis. He's a judge on the Second District Court of Appeals. He was appointed by DeWine to that seat back in 2021. He's now running for the Supreme Court. However, he has since withdrawn his name from consideration, although he says he's still running for the seat. He says that he didn't want a contested endorsement because there's about four or five people running for that seat now. He didn't want a contested endorsement to divide the party. There's also questions whether or not he would have had enough votes in order to get the endorsement. You need to have a majority of the 66 members. And who knows if he had it. I was not counting votes. There's also questions whether our friends at Signal Ohio had a story about there's been some questions. He had a tax issue about a decade ago when he was the law director for the city of Xenia. I think he had not paid reported his taxes and paid all of his taxes on time. And the prosecutor there filed a charge against him. I think it all got settled out. I think he paid it. And he said it was just a mistaken paperwork. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're seeking higher office, sometimes that stuff can come back. So now the party did not endorse anybody in that race. There's questions whether they might actually do so. They don't have another meeting scheduled yet. The chair said, you know, they could, but he also said, you know, we had wide open primaries in the U.S. Senate races in the last couple cycles, and that didn't seem to have any, you know, effect on the candidate ultimately winning in the general election.
Yeah, Jake, this race is interesting just in the fact that there are not very many contested primaries going around right now. But this one is like overly contested because there's so many people running for this one seat because there's four or five people who want to run against Jennifer Bruner. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. I mean, read between the lines of the math change just laid out. If every time since we changed the rules, a Republican has won, I don't want to get too predictive here, but a Republican will probably win. Or a Republican is overwhelmingly favored to win that seat. So the primary is kind of what's setting the race. There are very, very few people in the state who are really looking into primary candidates for Supreme Court races and have the sophistication to discern one from another and say who has the jurisprudence we want in the Supreme Court. So an endorsement like the Ohio Republican Party is a huge, huge deal. I mean, in some interpretations, this is what really sets the seat.
Mm. And this was also the race, if you'll recall, that Justice Pat Fisher was looking to jump into. He was coming up against age limits, so he was looking to challenge Bruner so that way he could get into, you know,
be a judge past 71.
Be a judge past 71, yeah. Because he would not be able to run again. However, since he didn't get the endorsement or he didn't get the recommendation of the screening committee, he since said he's not going to seek the seat anymore.
Yeah. I mean, Haley, this is a lot for the average Ohio voter to digest, right? I mean, all these people wanting to be on the Ohio Supreme Court. It would be, is this one of those instances where an endorsement would help people pick because it would be on the card?
Yeah, I think so, especially for something like Ohio Supreme Court. You saw a lot of attention on these races, I think. Oh, time is confusing. I want to say it was last year. So it was the first Supreme Court races after the abortion rights amendment passed. There was a lot of attention on the Supreme Court races, I think, because a lot of people saw that as an extension of the abortion rights fight, making, you know, both sides wanted to make sure that the court reflected their ultimate goals when it came to the future of abortion rights in Ohio and how that issue would be litigated. But you don't have as clear of an issue in this Supreme Court race. And so because of that, it's hard to say if there's going to be as much attention on it as there was before. I mean, everything's getting more political these days, but I think a lot of people for next year's midterms are going to be thinking about the Senate race, the governor's race for sure, maybe some of their local congressional races. I'm not sure Supreme Court's going to get a whole lot of attention in people's minds.
Well, coming up, we are going to talk more about vaccines in light of changing directives. And we're also going to hear about Ohio sheriffs making some money from ICE detainees. That is when All Sides and the Reporter Roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides, and this is the Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And still with me in the studio, Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch, Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio, and Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. And Jake, you had a story that is tangentially related, but there was a huge ICE raid at a Hyundai facility construction site in Georgia on Friday. Nearly 500 workers were detained. They were building a new factory. Some 300 will be returned to South Korea. But closer to home, prior to this, you were reporting on Ohio jails are being basically rented out to ICE. Essentially, hundreds of people are being held here in Ohio. Can you tell us about that? Why are sheriffs wanting ICE detainees from wherever here in Ohio?
Yeah, well, I think it the big picture, you know, after a raid like that happens, this is a huge country. You have, I think ICE is currently in detaining about 60,000 people around the nation. That's according to their data. All those people need to get out of this country, sometimes to the place where they're believed to have come from. Sometimes just we're doing third-party deportations now, which I believe is new. But in any event, you just need somewhere to put all those people, and ICE does not have that housing, but sheriffs and regional jails do. They have more jail beds than there are suspects being held for crimes. So there are four sheriffs that current, according to ICE data, there are four sheriffs that currently have detainees right now. There are about four more sheriffs that have contracts. There's a lot of opacity in this arena, so I wouldn't take any of these numbers too firmly. But these sheriffs are, the details vary, but it's usually about $100 to $125 per head per day. ICE is paying them. They are holding these people for anywhere up to, I think, 2 months is the average in some of these jails. But it can be longer. It's really an indefinite hold until ICE, you know, irons out the logistics of deporting a person. So these people, immigration is a civil offense. It is not a crime in this country. But they are being held indefinitely in these county jails without having been accused of or convicted of a crime until ICE deports them. And it's our county sheriffs who are just really upholders, traditionally upholders of state law, who are providing this hospitality.
Well, your story did cite at least one sheriff who said, sure, this is a moneymaker for us. I mean, $125 a day times 60 days, and the cell was empty anyway, right?
Yeah, that was Mahoning Sheriff Jerry Green. He has about 90 detainees in his custody on behalf of ICE, and I think he's making $125 per head per day off them. And he said that there's a, quote, clear financial benefit for the county. He talked about the creation of a rainy day fund with this money. And some people who are, you know, opposed to what's going on with the immigration system here, they're saying if you have empty jail beds, the answer is to have fewer jails. You know, we should save money. And sheriffs are looking at the other side of that equation saying, how do I capitalize on these empty jail beds I have? This is a great way to fill space. You know, it's if you're just looking at it in terms of dollars and cents, it's an obvious decision. But there are some sheriffs who are showing indications of a more ideological bent. You have guys like Sheriff Richard Jones in Butler County. He has put up an illegal aliens here, direct quote, sign outside the jail. He has never missed an opportunity to go on Fox News and talk about immigration as a national issue. You have Sheriff Bruce Zukowski in Portage County. They have one of these contracts. He came into the news in September 2024 publicly comparing immigrants to, quote, illegal immigrants to, quote, locusts. And now he has one of these contracts with ICE. So I think that there are two buckets that these eight sheriffs fit in of the financially motivated and the more perhaps ideologically motivated.
Well, I encourage our listeners to read Jake's story at Signal Ohio, but also what you just said about these sheriffs having these signs outside related to these detainees makes me wonder what kind of treatment they're receiving. I mean, are they being treated okay?
The sheriffs say they are. The Buckeye State Sheriff's Association, and for the record, the Buckeye State Sheriff's Association has denied the existence of any kind of profit motive at play here. I will add that in Butler County, there are two men. One is from Cameroon, and I can't remember the other country, but they are suing the Butler County Jail and some of its officials in federal court. They are saying they were physically abused. One of them said he had his teeth punched out by guards. He has a picture included in the lawsuit of him, you know, just exposing his gums and showing two missing front teeth. The officials deny any wrongdoing. The case is still going through the federal court system. Mm-hmm. But that was back in 2020, so I think immigration has only become a hotter issue with more aggressive enforcement from the federal government. So I think that lawsuit is one to catch your eye on, and lawsuits like that tend to be the things that sweep a lot of information into the public view.
And these sheriffs who are housing these detainees, it's not just in Ohio. I mean, they're around the country.
No, they're all around the country. Mm-hmm. There are something like, I think, 900 different offices in 35 states. These are called 287G contracts, and ICE puts them on their website. ICE is very proud of this. This is just a converse of the whole sanctuary city debate. You know, instead of cities saying you cannot participate, these are sheriffs saying we would like to participate. We want a role in this immigration scheme.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News and the Reporter Roundtable. That's Jake Zuckerman, a reporter for Signal Ohio. With us, we also have Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service, and Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. I wanted to move on a little bit to talk about vaccines and Vice President J.D. Vance's response to it. The U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. faced contentious hearings over his vaccine policies and his firing of the CDC director. He was coming under fire from a lot of different people in this hearing, and Vice President J.D. Vance weighed in on X, he accusing those who lectured Kennedy of supporting off-label, untested, irreversible hormone therapies for children and manipulating kids and enriching big pharma. He added a lot. So, Haley, those aren't words we typically hear from vice presidents of the past, you know, coming out like this. How would you assess J.D. Vance and his role in the White House and speaking out, you know, about something like this?
He has become a very reliable spokesperson of the White House's agenda. Trump is quite comfortable sending him out to events, kind of sending him to do television interviews, especially on the big Sunday shows. There's been no effort by White House staff to rein Vance in on social media. This kind of aggressive, almost troll-like behavior on social media has been part of his brand for a while, and I think Trump and Vance's allies see that as a good thing, and so that has continued as he's been vice president.
And you know, in addition to what happened with RFK, there's a lot of talk about school vaccination rates, and school vaccination rates are below where state health officials want them to be. Ohio's director of health, Bruce Vanderhoff, a couple of weeks ago, said vaccines are safe and effective, and he urged parents to get their children vaccinated. He described how the number has fallen from the 2019 school year, where 89.9% of kindergartners met all the vaccine requirements. Here he is.
The percentage of kindergartners who met all requirements was down to 85.4%, or a drop of nearly 4.5% over 5 years.
So we're hearing a lot of people come out and say, you know, get rid of vaccine mandates. But our Ohio's health director, Bruce Vanderhoff, is urging parents to get their children vaccinated. He wants that number back up where it was. What do you make of this climate of confusion with vaccines and who we're supposed to believe?
Okay. I think it's hugely problematic and incredibly reckless right now. I mean, we've had our first measles cases. We had a child measles death this year. I mean, I loathe to get too deep into opinion, but this is just such a settled issue in that vaccines prevent infectious diseases. Vaccines eradicated polio. It's really something else that this is somehow become debatable and somehow become controversial. I mean, the concepts of herd immunity, just basic disease theory have been around since the late 1800s. I don't know. It's an alarming sign that the political conversation has gone so far backward in terms of the science of what we know. And it's even more alarming that something like what Dr. Vanderhoff was just talking about, that clearly childhood vaccination rates are following that political conversation.
We mentioned Senator Huestra's comments earlier about vaccines, saying that the federal government shouldn't be mandating them. And I found that interesting because he came, of course, from Governor DeWine's administration. And, you know, DeWine, Dr. Vanderhoff, these are leaders that are going to highly recommend vaccines, that are going to continue to promote that message and really counter the message that we're hearing from folks like RFK about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So I just, you know, DeWine was a leader during the COVID-19 pandemic. A lot of Republicans viewed that as a bad thing, but a lot of people thought it was a good thing.
Shane.
DeWine's talked about also, I think, going back to remembering when they first started giving out like the polio and the measles vaccines and that, and lining up to get the polio vaccine. So a lot of these leaders who have kind of tried to speak out against it, I mean, they're close enough. They remember what it was like when these diseases were pretty rampant. I mean, Mitch McConnell, I think he
got sick, right?
He survived polio.
He survived polio.
So he's the one person who voted against RFK Jr.'s, the one Republican who voted against RFK Jr.'s confirmation.
Yeah. Okay. So basically we're saying Governor DeWine is older than Governor DeSantis. Mm-hmm. So Governor DeSantis in Florida, they did get rid of their vaccine mandate. So none of you think we'll see Ohio following suit of Florida.
I mean, not while DeWine is governor, but DeWine is governor for just another year and a half or so.
I would argue Ohio does not have a vaccine mandate. We have a requirement that kids get vaccinated, but we allow exemptions to that requirement for anything, for reasons of conscience or, I think, philosophical.
Yeah.
So it's like it's like you're required to do something, but you are allowed out of that requirement. I'd call that not a requirement.
Okay. Got duly noted. We have just a couple of minutes left. Jake, I wanted to talk about solar projects for a minute. A lot of these solar projects are getting a lot more thumbs down than thumbs up nowadays. Can you give us an update on where solar stands here in Central Ohio? How are we doing with solar projects?
Not well.
Yeah.
Utility scale solar has gotten incredibly difficult to develop in Ohio. There have been restrictive state laws passed that give counties new, basically local veto power rights over specific projects. They can pass referendums to ban solar within their counties. And even the Power Siting Board, using some of the old state laws for some projects that were quote unquote grandfathered in from the new law, the board has found ways that their reasoning is being challenged at the Supreme Court in a couple different cases right now, but they have found ways to basically say townships, county commissions have passed statements, resolutions in opposition to these projects. Therefore, these projects are not in the quote public interest, convenience, and necessity, and have been shutting them down. So this has happened to about 6 utility scale projects. So you're talking enough power that could have generated, could have powered millions of homes. They're getting shut down. And even when the developers win out, which does happen in some of these cases, you get huge uncertainty and years added to the timeline, development costs spike. And now with some of the federal subsidies going away, it's a really icy development climate for solar in Ohio.
Yeah. And not all of the objections are related to people who just don't want these in their backyard or they're worried about farmland. I mean, there's a lot more to it in some of these cases.
You hear things about it'll spoil rural community view sheds. People worry if, you know, what will happen to my home valuations if I get a solar farm across the way? Does no one want to live there? There's research that says nothing. It won't impact your home value, but people, you know, it's people's biggest financial asset and they feel very strongly about it. There's clearly some irrationality when you hear these vague concerns about groundwater contamination from solar, which is really just based on nothing. You do hear some stuff about drainage, erosion, noise. You know, I mean, you hear these things, but I think what's always worth considering is we don't allow any of this local power to communities who have opposition to gas projects, to coal mining projects, to any kind of it's only for solar and wind and power. Like, the ugly truth of power siting is we put all this ugly, noisy, dirty stuff in these usually poorer and rural areas. and communities have been stuck with it. You know, right now we've, you know, there's fracking going on in state parks. People have vociferously opposed that, but the state has said, we control energy. Energy is our domain. This project's going forward, but with solar especially, it's the locals that get to call the shots, and locals will almost always, it's a NIMBY problem. They will always reject them.
Well, I want to thank you for your time today. This has been the Reporter Roundtable. Thank you, Jake Zuckerman, reporter for Signal Ohio. Thanks for being here, Jake.
Thank you for having me on.
And Haley B. Miller, state government and politics reporter for Columbus Dispatch. Thanks, Haley.
Thank you.
And Shane Stegmiller, reporter for Hannah News Service. Thanks, Shane.
Always a pleasure.
And if you missed any part of today's program, you can listen back at our website, wosu.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast, or all of our episodes are available in the free WOSU mobile app. Also, be sure to like our show on Facebook and follow the show on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is @AllSidesWOSU. Thanks to senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our student producers Iza Huck and Colin Simpson, and also video production by the Ohio Channel, board operation by Chris Johnston and Cameron Howard. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.